This is No Pink Spandex, episode 27, for Saturday, September 16th, 2006. People, Lisa J. I'm gonna be quick because my microphone is being stupid and whatever. So, interview, Matt Austin. Good times. There was some restrictions, according to his publicist. I couldn't really talk about Power Rangers that much, but I tried to get in some questions just a little bit, and we kind of ran out of time because I did not know that he was running short on time. I thought I had more time. No excuses, but I'm just saying. Oh my god, you didn't talk about Power Rangers. Oh my god, you're talking about, oh my god, this is the worst interview ever. Oh my god, we already know this. Oh my god. So I don't want to hear that, alright? Whatever, okay? So, I know I'm talking really fast because I don't know when my microphone is going to die. So anyway, I will see y'all when I see y'all, and stay away from that spandex. It does not breathe. Hello. Oh my god. Okay, I'm getting really valley. This is not good. This is not good at all. Let me just turn this off right now. Peace out.
Alright, so I just start off with, telling us a bit about yourself, where you grew up, etc., etc.
Where I grew up. I grew up in a small little suburb of Toronto named Thornhill. And then, literally, it's kind of like Springfield and Shermieville? Is that the other place that's, right next to Springfield on The Simpsons?
I don't even watch The Simpsons. That's how bad I am.
Literally 5 minutes away is Richmond Hill, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in Richmond Hill in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what to say there. Then, the high school that I went to was pretty much, typical, I got there through other people's backyards, 7 minutes away. So I didn't really get to choose my high school. It was kind of chosen for me based on my location.
Right.
And it wasn't really an arts-type school, so that was the kind of one drawback of it. So anything having to do with arts wasn't really pushed by the school or the teachers. There was stuff going on, but because it wasn't an arts-focused school, when a play came around and people auditioned, there might have been 4 people auditioning.
Oh, okay.
So I was in theater and I did film projects, but I was kind of the only one. So I never, if you're the only one doing something, you never really know how, if you're good at it.
Right.
So it wasn't until university when, I was I auditioned for roles in high school. I might as well do it in university. While there, I auditioned for a play called Murder Pattern, and instead of 2 other people auditioning, it was 200 other people.
Okay.
Or however many, and I got the part, and then I was like, oh, I guess I can do this. So after that year, I dropped out, moved back to Toronto, moved into my parents' basement for a year, moved out into my own apartment, and started trekking.
So why did you decide to drop out? Were you focused on acting in at the university, or no?
Unfortunately, the university I chose when I got accepted had a theater program. And when I unpacked my bags, the university no longer had a theater program.
Oh, snap.
Between that summer and the fall, anyone that was already in the program could continue, but anyone that was new to the program had to choose other courses. So I didn't take any theater while I was there. I took media classes and journalism and film. And the film class, well, the film program didn't really have anything to do with actually making film. It's kind of discussing film.
Right.
And I wanted to make and be in film, so I decided I would do that in the real world and learn my lessons there.
Okay, so so was this always like a childhood dream of yours to get into acting in the film business, or was this just born when you went to school?
No, when I was younger, I wanted to be a superhero.
Makes sense.
Yeah, but I was, you know, fascinated with Superman,
right.
And kind of like in a Santa Claus isn't real type of fashion. My mother had to tell me one day that Superman wasn't real and I couldn't really aspire to be Superman,
mm-hmm.
and that it was an actor playing a role. And then that's when I kind of was like, oh, okay, then all right, I'll do that. So yeah, it was a childhood fascination for sure. But you know, when you're going through high school, you're still figuring out what you're good at and what you want to do, and sometimes mm-hmm. those things are different.
Right.
So kind of came to me, I guess.
Right, right. So like, what was your first? What was the first film that you tried to produce on your own?
The first film that I tried to produce on my own was during my last year of high school. It was a film called Now Endsville, and it was basically highly influenced by Reservoir Dogs.
Right, okay.
And which was like, it had just come out. Right, I think it came out two years earlier, but it had just come out, you know, to me.
Right.
Around that time, or the public, and I made a film basically about a hitman who walks around school trying to find the student who he's supposed to take out and can't find him, and then ends up going to the John, and that's where he finds him. And that was my film.
Oh, okay.
That was the first kind of time that like I had really, you know, taken my dad's video camera, edited, scored, you know, written dialogue, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's a good film. I wouldn't necessarily say it's shot well, but some people thought that, I guess it was encouragement from other people from it. They saw it and they were like, oh, well, one day you might do something better than this.
Right, right. They saw potential.
That was the first thing. Yeah, so that was the first thing that I kind of got my hands dirty with. But the first official project that I would like I produced in an efficient manner was a short-lived pilot for a TV series called Stay Crispy in Milk.
Oh, okay. What was that about?
It was about a guy who, I mean, the tagline is they often say neuroses leads to a soggy life. And it's basically about a guy who yearns to be the best waiter out there.
Right.
And instead, acting keeps interfering with his waiting job.
Oh, okay. So it's the other way around, usually.
Yeah, usually it's the other way around. But yeah, no, he wants to be like the top-notch waiter. He wants to be the guy that people always ask to be sat at his table.
Oh, okay.
So I think I was 21, and I was meeting with networks and things, and I'd written 20 episodes, and a pilot got made, and promises got made, but were never really delivered upon, so it kind of got stalled as more acting opportunities came up.
Duh. Oh, wait, I didn't hear that last part. It became what?
I said it kind of went into like a permanent hiatus as more acting opportunities came up.
Oh, okay. Unfortunately. I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, so it's still on a shelf, unedited somewhere.
Really?
It's just not on a shelf in a place that I live in.
So you must go and reclaim it.
Yes, and I will. It will be a quest, like it'll be like the quest for the Holy Grail. I will reclaim my videotape.
Goodness. So, I mean, I looked at your website, I looked at other websites, and you have done so many of your own projects and your own films. I don't have enough time to even name them all, but I was just wondering, out of all these films, what were some of the shortcomings that you didn't expect? Or are you just like, well, expect the unexpected, and you weren't really surprised by anything that, like, was thrown at you?
No, I definitely learned my first film that had success and made me money and made people ask me what's next on a professional level was Jimmy.
Okay.
It's a short film about a 12-year-old child that was addicted to heroin.
Right, yes. I remember clearly.
And yeah, that was supposed to be like a... It was my intention behind that was to make like a TV half hours, 22 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to make like a 22-minute kind of news story that had it got bought by television and you were flipping by from, I don't know, you know, the OC, and you were flipping channels, you would come across this film, but you would feel like it was a news broadcast.
Oh, okay.
So I shot it like that with, you know, broadcast quality cameras and lighting and an interviewer and a reporter and narration and voiceover of the reporter and, you know, a kind of a current affair 2020 style graphic that came in. But my sound recordist on the actual day of shooting didn't do his job properly.
Oh, no.
So all of the digital footage that I had was unusable unless I had spent a considerable amount of money getting, you know, the actors in to kind of redo their lines in a studio or to reshoot it. And it was all my own money. So I, you know, I got quite upset. I punched some things. I had a good cry.
No.
Which lasted for like a year. But I don't know who or what, or if it was just kind of one of those epiphany moments. It was kind of like the film ended up being shot on the film that, you know, people can see is shot on Super 8 black and white and color film.
Right.
And so that doesn't have sound with it. So I kind of looked at that footage and was like, man, this footage is great. It kind of looks like, you know, somebody found it almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you move into an apartment and there's a box or something, and it's like, oh my god, what's this? So I kind of just decided, okay, it's not my original idea, but I'll do the voiceover in my bedroom and I'll splice it together, and it'll be like 5 minutes, short and sweet, to the point. And so that's what I did. So I really asked me about, you know, things I learned, and is that no matter what project you do, and it's happened on every one of my projects, like something is going to go wrong that you could have never anticipated.
Right.
And that is almost a blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand.
Because I think it's a better film. I think the film I ended up with is better than what I would have had or went further or did more for me, or whether it's on a career path or did more for me as far as my own pride in my work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like on every film I've worked on, whether it's something that I've produced, directed, written, or been in, some sort of accident has happened, or some sort of roadblock steps in the way and says you can't do this, and then you go, you got to decide, are you going to go over it, through it, or around it, and usually it ends up being a different product than you ever thought you were going to have, but I think it's definitely a good thing.
Right.
I think.
And of
course, I'll let you know when I have a $1 million budget to work with and that happens. It might not be seen as a good thing then.
So, like, so that's where you see yourself, like, down the line, like, making big movie, like, works and what have you? Or do you just see yourself, like, sticking into the indie circuit and what have you?
Well, you can only be in the indie circuit for so long before someone offers you a large amount of money to do something.
Right.
That being said, and I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm waiting for the money, but if it's a project that I like, I mean, that's luckily all my peers are, you know, either like right along with me, behind me, or slightly ahead of me, so I don't have really any perspective on like what happens when, you know, the Weinstein brothers knock on your door and say, "We liked your little film. Here's $10 million to do, you know, Blade Runner 2."
Right.
I like watching sci-fi, but I don't really like making. I don't really. There's nothing. I never wake up going, "I want to make a sci-fi."
Mm-hmm.
So for that amount of money, I'd probably say I'm not so good at that. Like, I think you got to make things that you love.
Right, right.
There's no point, like, you know, I like listening to classical music, but, you know, I wouldn't want to make a biopic about Mozart.
Yeah.
Someone out there who probably loves Mozart, knows everything about him. I want to make the films that I get excited for.
Mm-hmm.
I guess so. If that is something with, like, you know, shot on the weekends with a dedicated crew for, you know, thousands of dollars, or if it's a film where I get to say, this is what I want, this is how I want to look, and this is who I want, and I can get it.
Right.
I'm not going to say no.
Right, right. You know, unless it just happened that, you know, you get a big investor and they're going to give you all that kind of money, then you're like, oh, bonus.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I don't want to say when you're an artist, but when you're at this stage of the game, whatever you're doing, you know, you're constantly told you can't do it.
Right.
And you go, yes, I can, yes, I can. And you find the people that can help you, you know, pull you up. I don't think you're ever really ready for when someone says, okay, you can have that. It's like, then what do you do?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no one really prepares you for success.
Right.
You're always taught, get up and try again, get up and try again, dust yourself off. So, yes, if someone happens to come along, you know, and wants to help me, first of all, I'll be very excited. But then it's like, oh my gosh, what happens now?
Mm-hmm. Actually, if you weren't into the film business, whether it be acting, writing, or directing, what would you be doing now?
If it wasn't either of those four things?
Yeah.
I mean, the answer I kind of go with is I'd be making music, but I think that's still pretty close to it. That's still telling stories.
Right.
So I'm going to try and think of something.
Well, I mean, you know, music is a rare voice. I happen to like this said music.
I'd say teacher.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'd be teaching how to make films and stuff like that?
I mean, that'd be great, but it wouldn't even have to be that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think I'd be, you know, a gym teacher, or I certainly wouldn't want to be a guidance counselor. Not because I wouldn't want to be that; it's just I don't know. I don't want to shape the minds of young people like that. I mean, you're crazy. Don't tell your parents. But yeah, definitely something working with kids. They make me laugh.
Aw. Yeah, actually, my mom teaches like 3 and 4 year olds, and
oh, 3 and 4. You know, wow.
Yeah, and it was, like, the first, like, couple of months, she's like, I can't stand these kids. These kids are so, I can't stand these kids. And then, like, you know, they just, like, attached to you so well. It's like, oh, you know, I won't say my mom's last name, but, you know, but, oh, we love you. And it's so cute. So on the other hand, I wouldn't be able to deal with it, but I'm glad you are.
It's tough. It's the toughest job out there.
Right.
And I think people don't even appreciate that, like, kids remember. Like, I don't specifically remember who my teacher was when I was 4, but it definitely, you know, influenced me, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, going back to the music, actually, like, what type of music do you write, actually?
The type of music I write is my type of music. I've always listened to, and then I just threw his CD in my stereo the other day, and that's right, I still listen to CDs in this MP3 crazy world. Ben Folds 5.
Right.
And I was listening to his stuff, I was like, wow, I think I like his music so much because it kind of reminds me of me. Just in the way, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but his music really, really tells a specific story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every song tells a story. Every song is something personal, or an observation, or has emotion in it. But his songs in particular, they're almost like a mini novel, where you're taking on a journey. And I think that's the kind of music I write. It's always personal. Though I've only written after something has happened to me, or something I've done. It's pretty rare that I write a happy song when I'm sad, or a sad song when I'm happy.
Okay.
I said that completely the wrong way. usually the ironic thing is that when I'm upset or sad or depressed, I usually write quite kind of poppy, happy songs.
Okay.
Rock and roll.
Okay.
And when I'm really kind of really, really content and happy and invigorated and inspired, I usually write pretty dark, moody stuff, which is funny.
Yeah.
But
no, I can understand
that. That's the type of music I write.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I think it was, I forgot who said it, but mentioned that you wrote a song for SPD, and it was the song that Sid was singing, and I'm like, I wouldn't think that he would write that kind of song. So how did that come about exactly?
On Power Rangers, well, at first I thought I was so brave and had such great relationships with the producers that I said, how many episodes do we have this year? And they're like, 38, and this is at like episode 12. And I said, I think I'm going to write an episode. And they said, okay, go ahead. Like, let's see it. I'm like, okay. And then as the series went on, I just realized how hard they are to write. And how I really should be spending my time, you know, learning my lines instead of writing lines. And then an episode came up and Bruce asked me if, he said there's a sequence where there's this original song that we have to have because, Alicia's character Sid used to be in a band and she used to be like a Britney Spears and we need a song. And it's just about herself called,
right.
called me. And it's like, oh, all right, I can do that. So, I wrote and recorded some music with Alicia. Well, some of the lyrics ended up in the actual episode, but my actual arrangement or my composition of the song actually didn't end up. Mine was a lot more fun. But
yours was more what?
It was a little bit more rock.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like dance rock. I don't know what to call it. It was dancey rock. It was, yeah.
But it wasn't pop. It wasn't...
No, the composer that they work with kind of, like, took some of the lyrics that I created and added his own and then made it really sugary.
Okay. That's
how that came. That was a great experience.
Okay. I mean, you being a writer, how was it so hard for it to write a script? I mean, can you, like, talk about that a little bit?
For Power Rangers?
Yeah.
It's really hard because you have to know, you have to know what's coming ahead so far in advance before you even start writing. And okay. A, they weren't going to let me know that. And B, just they've been writing them for the writing team and writing them for 12 seasons already.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta wrap it up soon.
Okay. So I guess actually after the whole Power Rangers thing and you heading back to North America, because you're not going back to the United States, you're in Canada. So how was it meeting up with your fans, and how was it the reaction? How did you feel coming back to it?
Amazing. I mean, we were so far detached from it while we were there, because the show wasn't seen there, and when we got back, I think it had only been airing for 8 episodes in. So we had no idea. But coming back, and then the amount of, emails I get and letters and just, friends of my family who have kids that watch it or I get stopped at if I'm downtown by, just fans of the whole series in general. And it's been really great. I mean, I did it for the experience, but, you perform for people to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So hearing them or seeing them is why they got into the business.
Okay. All right. So, I know you got to go soon, so I'm trying to get, upcoming projects. What upcoming projects that you have, that you would like to share with us?
Well, I'm just wrapping up my production on Dirt, which is my feature film. You can find out more about it on my website, www.matt-austin.com. And in the next year, so fall release probably 2007, is my documentary called Don't You Forget About Me.
Yes, I read about that.
Which looks at how Hollywood portrays high school and talks specifically about how great John Hughes did that. And how it's kind of really fallen from that point. So watch it, support it, check out the website, Don't You Forget About Me, themovie.com.
Okay, and any final thoughts, message for your fans, anything you want to say right now?
If you've been listening, thanks for listening to my voice. I hope you've been entertained, and I hope to entertain you in the future.
My name is Matt Austin. You're listening to No Pink Spandex. What's the last thing?
Stay away from the spandex. It doesn't breathe.
So it's no pink spandex? is your show, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it's stay away from the spandex. It doesn't breathe.
Right.
Okay. This is Matt Austin. You're listening to No Pink Spandex. And stay away from the spandex. It doesn't breathe. That was awful. But completely usable now.
No, it's fine. Unless you want to do it again, it's fine with me.
You want me to just say the tag?
Yeah, you can say the tag.
Stay away from the spandex. It doesn't breathe. Trust me. I wore it for 8 months.